CliffCentral.com.
Life carries on. Indeed it does. CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning. Every Thursday you may have become accustomed to having a conversation with us about all the current affairs events on the planet, but more especially those that affect you here in South Africa. And the Burning Platform every week is brought to you by Nando's. It's a chance for us to talk about all the things that affect us in this country, obviously, most, and then obviously the things that have a corollary effect on all those countries closest to us and eventually branching out into the whole world. Now, we're joined this morning by somebody who I've wanted to have on the show for the longest time, JJ Cornish. I see him every now and then, and we always have fascinating conversations, so I thought it would be a great opportunity to talk to him today. He is not only the Africa expert, he's been in radio and as a journalist for many years. He is a former newspaper editor. He's also been doing research into how the continent is faring during these trying times. We're glad to have him on the Burning Platform this morning, but he has been working for, among others, Radio France International, Agence France-Presse, and the BBC, Mail and Guardian, independent newspapers, Media 24, and 702. JJ Cornish, nice to see you, my friend.
Bonjour to you.
Good. And I'm hoping that you're in good health and you don't have the coronavirus and that you're locked down safely somewhere with family.
I'm locked down with she who must be obeyed. And it's been remarkable. We've only been married 46 years. You know, we're still feeling our way around. But it has been a remarkable experience. I've grown to love her even more. It's quite amazing. And but any better, I'd have to tell the cops. I'm in immensely good health.
So, JJ, there's lots to talk about this morning. And maybe the best place to start is to ask you about the many sources that you have across the continent. You're constantly in interaction with diplomats, with governments, with other media and journalist colleagues all over the place. How is Africa doing in the midst of what the world is being affected by at the moment? Do we have some statistics? Do we have some information? Do we have some idea of how the continent as a whole is dealing with this?
Well, you know, we are still behind the curve, as it were. Yeah, there was a warning today from the Food and Agriculture Organization that there's 5 million children under the age of 5 years old in the Horn of Africa suffering or facing an unprecedented food security problem. And this is because of COVID-19, but also because of the plague of locusts in that area and then of flooding that comes at that time. But it's unprecedented. It's biblical, isn't it, when you think about it, the plague of locusts and so on.
It really
and these
is.
These hoppers now breeding with the rains coming in ideal circumstances, and they will then move and they will be flying and swarming, swarms that black out the sun. That's the size they are. And they're landing in June and July. That's so bad is that they are now 9 times larger than they were 3 months ago when they were first experienced. And there's no insecticide because of the lockdown. So it's just frightful what is happening in that part of Africa. The death toll, or the cases are 3 times larger than they were a month ago. So it's very, very frightening that we have around the continent. For example, in Nigeria, in the Kano state, that northern state which suffers the attacks from Boko Haram,
yes,
there they have hundreds of pneumonia deaths. The Nigerian authorities insisting that it's not COVID-19, but we can't be sure. You know, this is the problem with COVID-19. However knowledgeable we like to sound about it, we simply don't know. And Nigeria, like here in South Africa, we're having to relax some of the lockdown simply because of public pressure, having to do it. And are we doing it, you know, are we going to go too fast? There are parts of Abuja and Lagos that Muhammadu Buhari, the beleaguered Muhammadu Buhari, is forced to relax lockdown on. But in Kano now, he's increased it for 2 more weeks because of these deaths. So it's that kind of patchy picture we're getting all over Africa. The north, the Maghreb states and the Mashrek states, you know, Mashrek being Mpumalanga type thing, and Maghreb being where the sun sets.
Yes.
They got the first, and they've had the worst because they've been closest to Europe, which is where, the epicenter.
You're talking about Algeria and Morocco.
Libya. Algeria, yeah. Morocco. Strangely enough, Western Sahara, occupied by Morocco, has had fewer cases and fewer deaths.
So, JJ, as you say, a patchy picture is starting to emerge. Do we know the case in our immediate neighbors, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, Mozambique, and even just a little bit further north, Zambia, perhaps? Do we know how they're faring?
They're doing better than in the north, but nevertheless, I mean, Botswana has had this incidents where their cases are fairly low, but they had those MPs. In fact, every one of their MPs has been put into isolation. Not that they've obeyed it, you know, so we've seen shopping and so on, and then put into sort of more enforced isolation. In Mozambique, they're fighting it as hard as they can, but they have the problem in Cabo Delgado, the northern section, which is under the threat of the jihadi attacks. And any hope of Mozambique coming out from being one of the poorest countries on the planet because of this natural gas that has been found. Mm. Now, that's been put on hold for at least 5 years. The big deal that Total was supposed to, and ExxonMobil was due to sign, has been delayed for at least 5 years. So those sort of economic problems, and we speak about COVID-19 and the way they're fighting it, but it's really the economic impact that we and our neighbors are going to feel most sorely.
Didn't Donald Trump promise a whole bunch of ventilators to Nigeria?
Yes, and let's remember that they're called ventilators, because certain members of our should be more knowledgeable spokespeople called them something else. Yeah, he did make this promise, but does he have the promise, the capacity to keep it? There were hospitals in the United States saying, we cannot find a ventilator for love nor money. And here he's saying, sure, I'll promise you this. And I mean, we don't know if it is official because it hasn't been tweeted, Gareth.
Yeah, of course, that's the way he
But the fact is, the information minister of Nigeria is saying yes in a telephone conversation on Tuesday. He made this promise. But today, the United States is back in on the African scene, in that we have Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, saying to South Africa and Qatar, you should get rid of those Cuban doctors that have come. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he's calling it soft power by Havana. Well, I mean, you know, I think the exercise of soft power anywhere in the world is a good thing, as opposed to hard power, you know. But nevertheless, they're saying and telling the doctors that they should be, they should defect. I don't know why he's got more things to worry about than Cuba sending doctors to South Africa. And I have things to tell you about those doctors if it's opportune.
Tell us about those, and then I'll bring Canton Pillay in a moment, because he's actually written something about the locusts that you mentioned earlier. But before that, what are your feelings on the Cuban doctors who arrived to great ceremony and fanfare the other night, it has to be said?
They certainly did, and we're paying millions, million at least, to have them.
$400 million.
You know, the Cuban threat goes back to the apartheid days when we fought the Cubans in Angola.
Yeah.
Now, so that side of the coin always sees a threat from Cuba. But then the Cubans sent doctors here in shortly after the onset of democracy. And an amazing bunch. I was still doing articles. I think I did something for Business Day on them. I went to see them at Groblersdal, just outside of Pretoria.
Yeah.
And not the world's capital of rock and roll, I think we'll accept. But there were these Cubans living very cheerfully and very in a big house with a tennis court and a pool and quite enjoying life here.
Yes.
But the point was, they were so diligent that that on their days off, I suppose, as I say, not a great deal to do on your days off, but on the days off they had, they were doing the rounds. And the superintendent at the hospital told me that they would have to have closed the Groblersdal hospital were it not for the Cuban help. And I met these guys now and again afterwards. You know, they came for dinner at some diplomat's home and so on. And they were the most impressive bunch of people. And really felt, I mean, this the soldiers in white, the Cubans like to call them, and what Mike Pompeo is saying, and some countries like Brazil, Ecuador, Bolivia have actually got rid of Cubans. They've had more than 500,000, 600,000, in fact, that have gone to 50 countries in the last 50 years. So, I mean, they've been all over the globe. But there's an argument that a lot of their money, what they're being paid, actually goes back to Havana and not to them, and that they are the victims. Well, I didn't get that from the Cuban doctors that I met here. And the point is that they're very, very good. Nobody can dispute the fact that medical care in Cuba is absolutely top rank, and that we need their help. And if countries like Qatar also take them on, then clearly there's a lot to be said for the benefit that they can be.
Careful, you're starting to sound like Bernie Sanders with his, well, Cuba, at least they've got good health care. So, JJ, I want to bring Canthan in here because I know he's got something to say, first of all, about the locusts in the Horn of Africa. Canthan, welcome, our returning champion to the burning platform this morning. Do you want to address that, first of all, just what's going on in the Horn of Africa as per JJ's comments earlier? Canthan? Seems like we've got some kind of connection issue with him. You've, by the way, great sound on your side, JJ. I always find it's necessary in these conversations to compliment people when they do have a good connection. Canthan, are you there? I don't suppose.
Canthan, it hadn't occurred to you to say great content instead of great sound.
No, that's a given. I mean, that's one of the reasons we have you.
I did a webinar the other day
for
the business school, UJ, the Johannesburg Business School, and I was my background, which is not the most impressive that you can see. The listeners can't hear it, so they asked me to get a better background. So I especially put some books and, you know, very studious looking books.
Yeah.
You know, my full three set version of the Kama Sutra and stuff like that. Sat down in a club eating, but then balanced my computer on my ample belly, and there I was talking and with again, she who must be obeyed, helping me at every stage. And she found that I had to, they kept messaging her saying, tell him to stop moving the television screen. Because I had it on my belly, and as I breathed in and out, my face was going up.
Yeah, I think we're all learning the ways of doing this properly.
It is. It isn't easy. And when we saw the parliamentary committee hearings yesterday, you realize that we've learned more than they have, eh?
Yeah, that's true. My God. All right, let's get – because that was the education people that you're talking about now, when they were making their announcements about when people can go back to school, and none of them knew how to operate this technology. You can see that it's all very, very new to them. Canthan, are you there? No, I can't hear Canthan. Still can't hear him, see? I don't know what's going on there. It seems very odd. So, okay, while we're waiting for Canthan to rejoin the conversation, JJ, COVID-19 unemployment is apparently going to slash a fifth off remittances to poor countries. That's from the World Bank.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, remittances are three times what foreign aid is. So the money going back to Africa from people working abroad is three times greater than the foreign aid. So without these remittances, and there's pieces today saying we're going to starve to death. You know, these people, some of the people go, have to cross the Med and risk their lives to get there. But once they do, they start sending money back home. Now, remittances from Italy to Africa have dropped 90%.
My God.
Remittance from Africa from Britain to Africa have dropped 80%. So this is, when you talk about lifeblood, you know, an absolute conduit, providing the very survival of many, or supplying the survival of many families, is now disappearing because of the unemployment caused by COVID-19.
Yeah, and this unemployment may have a greater toll on people than the threat of the virus. This is what more and more experts are starting to discover. is that a lot of people would rather take their chances with this virus, which, you know, overwhelmingly affects people who are suffering from one of the supposed comorbidities is what they call them. So it overwhelmingly affects those people. The rest of the population seems content to take their chances with trying to get Canton, I think you've rejoined us, with trying to get money into the household and food on the table.
Well, you know, this is the most frightening thing about it. Earlier on, I mean, you know, some weeks ago, you saw Italians desperate, without any food, actually raiding supermarkets, trying to break the windows of supermarkets. You know, we saw that. And when people are absolutely desperate, they're going to, you know, if the family is starving, they're going to do what they can.
Yeah, they'll resort to whatever measures are necessary.
Absolutely. So the situation is, and I still believe there's a modicum of this belief that COVID-19 is a white man's ailment and something that, you know, and I believe that as it takes a more bitter hold in Africa, that will disappear entirely. But there is that belief. And also the youthful population of Africa believes that the COVID-19 hits the young less than it does the old. And so, yes, they would rather take their chances with the disease than with the prospect of actually starving.
So, Canton,
the Sweden approach, isn't it?
Sorry, say that again?
This is the Sweden approach, which is basically that.
Yeah, Canton, can we switch your video off?
To the young people allowed to go about their business.
Can we just turn your video off? Because I think that might be the problem. Yeah. You know, you are in the bustling metropolis of Plettenberg Bay. Yeah, that's a lot better. So let's just start off with the thing that I wanted you to comment on first, because you sent me a piece that you'd written called "A Plague on Both Your Houses," which deals with what JJ Cornish brought up just a moment ago about the Horn of Africa and this locust plague which they're dealing with over there. Do you want to just bring in your point of view on that one, and then we can move on from there?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, the biblical conspiracies had kicked in a short while before the actual COVID-19 pandemic became as epic as it is currently. But you can trace the plague of locusts in the Horn of Africa directly back to the war in Yemen, because that is the basic breeding ground for these things. And for the longest time, as long as you had relatively stable governments up in that part of the world, the scenario where that insect population was actually under control. Now you have this really vicious war that is taking place behind the scenes. No one reports it most of the time. But it has entirely depleted the ability of the agricultural sector such as it is still left in Yemen, to be able to control the spread of locusts up there. And essentially, they then migrate from there, and they spread all the way down through the Horn of Africa. It's fascinating. Unintended consequences of the war.
So just quickly remind me what that war in Yemen is all about. The Saudis are very much involved in the Yemen war.
Yeah, right? Look, it's essentially the reason why we have any conflict in the Middle East to start off with. It's fundamentally a battle for dominance between Sunni and Shia factions, depending on where you happen to be at a particular time. Mm-hmm. And what you've had is Iran-backed militias controlling significant parts of the country, and a Saudi-backed militia controlling other parts of the country. And the battle for dominance between them has been ongoing. But essentially, you do have the Americans and the UK providing both logistical support, and in the case of UK, air support as well, against the Iranian-backed rebels in that part of the world. But that means right now, Yemen is one of those unspoken stories in the world where the degree of famine that has been taking place in that country is massive. But nobody writes about it because theoretically the UK and the US are the good guys. And so, you know, damned if they're going to be saying anything about it. But it is a disaster. It's the Saudis, fundamentally.
JJ, what are your feelings on the AU and the role that they might or might not be able to play in COVID-19 and all the complications that arise from that? But also around this hurt that we've just heard this week, that women have asked the AU for financial support during the COVID-19
lockdown. Women from 48 of the 54 African Union members have appealed to the Continental Organization for financial assistance. Are the AU in any position to offer that kind of assistance?
You know, when we talk about the AU, it's like talking about the UN. That really is, it's not a body of its own. It's a body financed by the continent.
Yeah.
And so if the single countries, I mean, Africa, South Africa is one of the largest contributors there. So if South Africa suffers, you know, a negative growth and it shrinks to something like 10%, South Africa is going to have to worry about every penny for itself. And the other big contributors, Algeria and other countries like that, they're all going to, the finances from the AU will shrink enormously. So this, the moral and symbolic support that they can give, and we have this, for example, with the AU stepping in to address the racism in Guangzhou, you know, in China, the racism against black, against Africans living there, and the fear of the COVID-19, them bringing COVID-19 to that part of the country. So you can have that kind of symbolic move, but actually nothing that they can do that they're not doing already. They don't have the funds and the resources. So sometimes when they do peacekeeping, for example, they have to do joint operations with the United Nations. Mm. Well, the United Nations is under threat. With the European Union, what can they do? Well, you know, the European Union cannot agree or took a long time to agree on exactly how to help their own members.
Yeah.
So before they start, before you hand out any help to one country or to another country, you have to see that you're looking after your own people first, and that is where the priority will be. The African Union, the FEM group that raised the call for help from the African Union really was a feminist group, and they were talking about violence against women and children. You know that the number of child brides since the lockdown has now increased threefold. The violence against women is increased exponentially. And unfortunately, they mentioned South Africa as one of the countries that is experiencing this. South Africa has been on the roll of shame in a number of regards here, I'm afraid to say, Gareth. They're also the country that has had the police using excessive force to police the lockdown, to police the lockdown. And that has happened. We've been put on a list along with Hungary, you know, where we have Duterte killing drug dealers.
Yeah.
Now we're put in that league when it comes to policing our own lockdown. So lists and
not great. So, JJ and Canthan, while we're talking about the EU, because we are part of this global community now, and we are watching countries all over the world, and perhaps we're more comparable in terms of the way that this pandemic is going to affect us. We're more comparable to South America than we are to Europe. But while we're on Europe, and since you brought them up, I mean, what chances does the EU have of surviving this particular situation intact? They were already under huge pressure thanks to Brexit. We know that the Spanish and the Italians have been agitating for some time. France and Germany are trying to stand their ground and keep the union looking more or less like it's a strong thing that can survive any storm. But really and truly, the EU is facing a very bleak future at this point, isn't it? JJ, do you want to go first on this one?
Well, you know, we have the right-wing elements, and we have France, where we have
Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Yes, well, yeah. But Le Pen's daughter, in fact, who's broken with her husband.
Sorry, that's quite right. Marine.
With her father.
Yes, that's quite right.
Yes.
Sorry.
Well, she's a separatist. And there's no doubt that if they don't, and there was word within Spain and Italy that if they do not respond adequately to our needs now, then what is the point of being in that union? So there's no doubt that institutions the world over are going to have to relook at their own validity and their own viability as a result of this, but the European Union probably more than others. The Brexit, interestingly, the Brexit has made Europeans throughout all the 27 countries look at the viability, the long-term viability. You know, the thing about Europe is that European bureaucrats like to tell you and I that we don't know what we're talking about when we criticize Europe. And I think that's what happened with Britain.
Yeah.
I think the Brits simply got tired of being told what they should be thinking on Europe.
Right.
Just like American rednecks got tired of being told what they should be thinking about politics. And for that reason, they wreak their revenge by voting Donald Trump into power. In Europe, they wreak their revenge by every now and again with a referendum flying in the face of what the bureaucrats say. So it's high time that these bureaucrats or the European bureaucrats looked at really what the realities were, what the people were thinking on the ground, and COVID-19 is going to force them to have to do this.
What do you think of that, Canton?
Yeah, are you guys hearing me okay,
loud
by the way?
Clear, loud and clear.
All right, excellent. Look, I think what JJ is describing in terms of what's going on in Europe is actually a microcosm of the entire global debate that's taking place right now about globalization versus an inherent sense of self-sufficiency. And because basically at the point at which and suddenly people realized the amount of their own individual economies that were dependent on having China as the factory floor for the entire universe, as we know it, was something that was fundamentally going to lead to disaster. Well, it has in this particular case. A core of self-sufficiency that actually gets built up, then we are all in trouble. Now, translate that to the European level, and in fact, you know, Europe is the most visible example of the...
Of the what?
This time. And we had that scenario where Italy...
You broke up for a second there. You
the said globalization that. Project.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Europe is the first example of the globalization project being implemented for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so we had that scenario where Italy went for help first and foremost to the EU, and they got no help. Then picks up the phone to China and picks up the phone to Russia, and suddenly planes are landing. In the case of Russia, the planes were landing literally within 36 hours, laden with aid. And at that point, the Italians then began asking the question, well, if the EU is just so useless when it comes to doing this type of stuff, why are we in fact in this? So the question then, I understand Jean-Jacques' point that these guys happen to be right-wing, the separatists. Well, you know, fundamentally, they're nationalists. I think that, you know, in some cases, like the Le Pen family, they very clearly... bordering on racist, but significantly, there's been a growth of nationalism that has been popping up really throughout the world. Just this whole idea that we really need to be building internal capacity, and we really need to be ensuring that we are creating jobs here, creating jobs in China. So where does this leave us in the medium term? I don't know. One of the things that I want to touch on as well is this notion that we are currently experiencing an exponential spike in terms of domestic violence. You know, we're not able to provide statistics in Parliament on a real-time basis for crimes that occur on a daily basis. And suddenly, we've mysteriously acquired this capability in the midst of lockdown. I don't think so.
It's like the police figures on anything. Suddenly, they're available to Becky Pele, and he can say for sure crime has gone down. We were never privy to this stuff before, so how can we believe him?
You said
you're especially suspicious now because it's being used for political ends. By whom and what political ends?
Well, if you look in terms of people who trot out these figures that come from throughout the continent about women issuing desperate cries for help, generally, they end up being NGOs who play in that sector and rely upon funding flowing to their organizations. And it is one of those scenarios where they have to armist a scenario as possible. It's exactly like people who get their money space. And again, we go back to the scenario. It's not that there is no violence against women. It's not that there is no devastating violence against women taking place on the continent. But do organizations actually take advantage of every opportunity to try and push particular agendas?
They wouldn't be looking after their people if they weren't, right?
Exactly.
But Canton and JJ, there's quite a lot of conspiracy theory that's starting to bubble up now. And this was bound to happen because when countries are under pressure, when populations are under pressure, when they feel threatened, this is inevitably one of the things that starts to take place. Some of these conspiracy theories are that there are countries that are actually saying people are dying of COVID-19 when COVID-19 is not part of their diagnosis at all. For either being admitted to hospital or for developing conditions later on, which end up costing their lives. Do you believe that there are people who would want to inflate the number of COVID-19 deaths? And what might their purpose be in doing so, whether it's in South Africa or in the US or in Europe?
Yeah, I don't believe that there's a conspiracy theory here, guys. You know, I think this just happens to be one of those things. You know, it's the street light effect, you know, because of the fact that you can see things now, you're drawing a correlation that's not necessarily causation. Mm. So you do have an astonishing amount of deaths that take place on an annual basis relating to flu season, as an example. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that at this point, when a person ends up dying of pneumonia, as an example, we end up testing for COVID-19 antibodies and say, all right, this person has died as a consequence of this particular infection. In previous years, we have not necessarily done tests that check whether, you know, H1N1 or whatever variety has been floating around at any given stage was a contributing factor in that particular case, which is not to say that we should not be taking that seriously. But I think what it does mean is that going forward, a lot more circumspect around the number of deaths we report generally in across the world that are related to specific diseases. Mm. And we also perhaps need to be trying to see whether there is a common thread that runs through that. Well, I think by and large, when you've had deaths from natural causes. Sorry, Gareth, go ahead.
No. Keep going.
Yeah, I was saying, if you've had deaths from purportedly natural causes in the past, one hasn't necessarily gone and tested for specific antibodies to see whether this has been a contributing factor in this particular case.
Jean-Jacques, have you heard some conspiracy theories that you think have any weight at all? I mean, are you trying to avoid fake news as much as the rest of us are?
Yes, you know, I don't play conspiracy theories. I just find that it just obfuscates the job I tried to do. The fact is, and I used this expression before, we simply don't know. And, you know, that goes from the very top to the very bottom. We simply don't know. And we're learning so much. And every time I see a medical expert saying this, I feel somewhat heartened because, you know, this has made us think, as Canton mentions, when it's over, we're going to have to how we deal. We knew one thing, for example, we knew that a plague of this proportion was very, very possible. You know, there's that famous footage of Bill Gates talking about it 5 years ago.
And of George W. Bush and of Barack Obama, all of them having similar things to say.
Indeed. And suddenly we have a conspiracy theory that, in fact, it's Bill Gates is responsible for COVID-19.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think at this moment of fear, it's human nature, perhaps, to find a scapegoat, someone to blame. And so they will do all sorts of things. We see, unfortunately, from the White House, you know, the conspiracy theory moving through 180 degrees inside of the space of one news cycle. Who's to blame for it? How good, how well we're doing fighting it? How bad it is? I mean, obviously, Donald Trump needs to have really bad figures to show that the economy that he was, which was his stalwart, has, disappeared up its own behind, as it were. He's now going to have figures to justify that. But he's also going to have to try and appease his redneck supporters by saying things are getting better faster than lamestream media is reporting. So, this is the season of conspiracy theories. Mm. And, you know, on my hysterical neighborhood watch social media thing, all I'm getting is the warning that anybody spreading conspiracy theories will have the police knock on their door and lock them up. Yeah. So people are not only indulging in conspiracy theories, but realize the danger and are trying militantly to fight against conspiracy theories. The point is, I think it's something that we should have no hesitation in doing as communicators. And that is, when we don't know, admitting it and saying, I don't know.
Well,
there's one specific thing I need to climb in on, Gareth, and we have had very clearly in this case deliberate disinformation being spread to further particular agendas. And the most pronounced example of this for me is the fact that when this thing broke, we were all told don't wear masks.
Yeah.
And it only transpired later that the reason why they were spreading this entire agenda around don't wear masks is that they were afraid that the supply of masks would be depleted and there would not be sufficient masks out there in order to protect the health workers.
Right.
Now, this has been absolutely fucking disastrous because if they had said at that point, just tie a scarf around your face and when you go about your business, that would have had a huge impact in terms of actually slowing the spread of this thing. Someone gave me a very good analogy around this. He said, you know, imagine a world where all of you are running around naked and someone pisses on you. The chances are that you are going to get soaking wet. Now let's say you have a scenario where you have clothes on, the other person does not have clothes on. They piss on you. Your pants are still going to get wet. On the other hand, if that person is wearing clothes as well, and that person pisses, the piss then stays inside his pants. And that's the reason why we should all be wearing masks. And it is a brilliant analogy.
How do we get this image out of our minds, though?
Jean-Jacques, if we want to tell people the reason why they should be wearing masks, I think that this is a great example of how to tell people. But it goes back to the fact, guys, that the medical establishment lied to us, and they lied to us because they wanted to protect the supply of masks for themselves.
All right.
That, for me, is terrifying.
The
medical establishment lies to us.
Yeah, let's talk about lies for a second, because a lot of smokers feel like they were lied to by the president last week this time when he said, oh, no, level 4 means you can buy cigarettes. A capricious and unnecessary restriction on people's liberties, which was introduced by Nkosazana Zuma, who we know has some kind of an issue. There's something that happened in her past with smokers, which we won't speculate upon, but something in her detests smokers, except when they're illicit tobacco, and they're willing to fund her campaign at Nasrec. She has come out all guns blazing, said that she got 2,000 submissions from various people in society. I don't know whether to believe her or not, saying that no, they've got to keep this ban on selling tobacco products in place for as long as possible because it's very dangerous and it will help spread the disease. Now, smokers were going to go out tomorrow, probably in their droves, and empty the shops of cigarettes by buying them. They can't do that anymore. People feel that they've been lied to by the president. Do either of you have any point of view on this and the other capricious laws which have been brought about by, among others, the Minister of COGTA, Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs? Exercise only between 6 and 9 in the morning, for example, as if this makes the spread of the disease less likely at other times. What do you say to
that? Well, there's this entire atrocious distinction between essential services and non-essential services. And the point fundamentally is that every service is essential to someone who's part of the value chain for that. Whether it be the tobacco industry and it's the farmers that are producing the tobacco or the factories or the truck drivers or anyone in the distribution network, ditto in the case of alcohol. Really, our approach from the get-go should have been based on risk in a particular sector rather than whether or not a particular sector is essential. And if every business in this country has guidelines in place to minimize risk, then that is essentially the way in which you keep the economy ticking over. So, Gareth, I agree. This is entirely capricious. It's entirely irrational. But again, it's like the ban on selling hot chicken at Woolworths. You know, where do you actually justify it?
Yeah.
It makes no sense to me. It is based on whims and fancies. But don't let me get started here.
Do you remember the joke when Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma first brought in the smoking ban, that, you know, I would say, Gareth, I can walk in and have at you with a meat cleaver, and I'll probably get away with it, but dare I light a cigarette in your presence, you know, there's no doubt I will face the full might of the law. There's no doubt, too, that, you know, again, when I come back to this, we don't know. I think at the very highest levels, they don't know. We had Zweli Mkhize saying when the lockdown, just before the lockdown, that we would be able to exercise. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
A day later, then we had the police minister, Bekesele, saying, no, you won't. Yeah. So there was that contradiction. We had now, and Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma has contradicted the president on this issue of cigarettes. Capricious and quite mean-spirited. I mean, whatever opposition you might have to smoking, and as a former smoker, I'm quite strongly anti-smoking. But to deny smokers cigarettes has no bearing at all on the spread of COVID-19. With Nkosazana last night talking about Zol and passing Zol. It really was it's surreal. People passing cigarettes. Well, maybe that does happen. But is it going to materially affect the spread of COVID-19? I think what they've done is a mean-spirited thing and undermined the authority that they do need, or the moral high ground that they need,
if they want people to comply,
effectively police this and comply, you know, with it.
Because
people guys, hang on a second. Let me just toss something else into this. Let me just toss something else into this. In fact, what we are seeing out here is part of the entire jostling for power within, that the way in which Ramaphosa has actually arranged the handling of this entire thing is by delegating authority to individual ministries to take responsibility for how regulations are implemented within the scope of their particular ministries. And if you understand the jostling for power that happened back at NASREC between Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma and the president, you know, what better way than to actually cock a snook in the direction of the president than to turn around and say, no, I'm actually not going to allow cigarettes. And I'm going to make you out to be a liar. The president can only override her by overruling his own prior injunction that ministers will have responsibility for their individual departments. The Nkosazana's obsession with cigarettes does go back many years.
Tell me.
Which I thought was absurd. Because remember that most of the anti-smoking regulations that we have in the country right now were introduced during her tenure
as Minister of Health.
Yeah. And one of the things that she did at the time was she also legislated the amount of nicotine that could be had in particular brands. So, for example, you know, back in the day, I used to smoke. And I used to smoke Benson & Hedges Gold, which had one of the highest levels of nicotine around. And correspondingly, what that meant was that you smoked fewer cigarettes. So by mandating the reduction in the amount of nicotine, it immediately meant that in order to get the same amount of nicotine, you had to up the number of cigarettes that you were actually having, which was entirely counterproductive from the point of view of wanting people to reduce the amount of smoking that they were doing. Again, entirely unscientific, but this is part of the fact that there is a global lobby that gets substantial amounts of money to basically fight smoking, which is why you have the World Health Organization insisting that vaping needs to be treated in exactly the same way as smoking of cigarettes needs to be treated. It's absurd. They both happen to be nicotine delivery systems, but it's very clear that the health consequences of vaping are significantly lower than the health consequences that come from cigarettes. It doesn't matter that vaping is also dangerous. There are dangers associated with it, but everything is relative.
This is the government of low-hanging fruit, because it's easy to police things like tobacco, because you force the tobacco industry to comply or else you put them out of business. And what they're doing here seems to me to be like, well, we can't win by, you know, we can't get people in the townships, for example, to comply with our laws. They're still going to do what they were doing before lockdown. And largely they are in townships across South Africa. So instead, we'll punish the people we can. It's almost like, you know, they have to exercise some muscles of government, even if they're the wrong muscles. And you see how you know, they as Jean-Jacques already points out, you know, they to and fro and they jump around on these very bizarre notions of what they can and can't control. Now, do we have any idea of how long level 4 will last for? And do we have any idea of what level 3 might look like for now, as opposed to what it might look like when they change their minds again later on? And should we allow people in departments of government to be able to make these decisions about what are effectively people's liberties?
I have to quote Jean-Jacques at this point. We just don't know.
I've been the most sanguine participant in this with that. You know, Gareth.
Yes, you have.
In the past, at times of our greatest need, who have we turned to? Our courts.
Yes.
Those have been a bastion against apartheid, a bastion against corruption, a bastion against all these things. I believe that more and more and more we're going to have to do that in resisting the vagaries, and not to say the spitefulness and the cynicism that is being directed at us in policing this lockdown. So I think that we're going to see more and more people going to court. The fact is, though, you asked about level 4. We don't really know what level 4 is at this point. We simply don't know.
No.
And we don't know. We don't know about how long it's going to last. How can we possibly know? And 3, you know, I just wanted to mention this issue that Kenton brought in Sweden. I'm good on Sweden because my daughter teaches there.
Yes.
And you know, I'm very worried because she has to go into school every day.
Yeah.
But she gets on a bus and doesn't pay because the bus driver doesn't want to see anybody. And when she gets to school, her school has something like 10 pupils. So the headmaster says, well, have a couple of you come in anyway. The thing about the Swedes that I'm learning more and more is rather like, you know, the Germans who believe that they are right.
Yes.
And the Swiss who have a pathological fear of not being right. The Swedes sometimes believe somewhere in the middle of that we are the most reasonable people. I will say to you, as an adult, Gareth, this is what you should be doing. And as a good Swede, you'll simply do it. Now, I mean, we couldn't hope to do that anywhere in Africa, certainly not the Africa I know. I'm surprised that to some extent the Italians have done it, because they were the biggest, most anarchistic sort of country that I've ever come across. But in Sweden, they say we are making adult decisions. The fact is, it'll take some time before we know whether they got it right or whether their experiment was the most deadly thing. They certainly have, what, three times the number of Denmark's deaths and 6 times the number of Norway's deaths, and that's from their neighbors. So the Swedish experiment, if you want to call it that, is going to be a very interesting one. And won't they love it if their economy
is the only one that survives,
emerges quicker than others?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but fundamentally, that is the trade-off that we are talking about, because the thing that we need to understand is that the number of deaths is not going to be an indication. What is going to be an indication is the number of deaths over the entire duration of the epidemic.
And we'll only be able to calculate that right at the end.
Exactly. And so the point about flattening the curve is not reducing the number of deaths. We must remember this. So if the US and Sweden, for example, are having spikes right now, that means that they're also going to come out of the spike quicker. Well, at least based on what we know about how this actually transmits and how it spreads and how it actually eventually ends. So I think that if we take a look at the Swedish example right now, and if we take a look at the US example, right now, people are going into hysterics about the number of deaths in the U.S. Guys, you know, proportionally, we will, in fact, face those numbers of deaths in our country as well. It's just that what we are doing...
Yeah, it's a question of timing, that's all.
Yes, it's a question of timing. Exactly.
And there are people who seem to be laboring under the misconception, a fairly big misconception, that somehow the lockdown is the cure. It really isn't. It was brought in plainly, and it was explained plainly to people that it was brought in order to flatten the curve so that our healthcare system could cope. Mm. And we now see that there are places like the Cape Town International Convention Center that are opening themselves up as makeshift hospitals, should that big you know, the largest part of the curve, the big bulge in the middle of the curve, start to hit now. We are more prepared than we were a month ago, which is the point. But that does not mean that this is the cure. And it does worry me slightly, gentlemen, and maybe either of you who are interested in commenting on this, when Ibrahim Patel says, oh no, level four is just there to prepare us for the next 8 months. Does he mean that in a general sense? Or does he mean that we're going to have some kind of on-off lockdown over the next 8 months, which would no doubt bring not only the economy of this country to its knees, but very many more people to starvation and death? We simply cannot afford for this thing to roll over for month after month after month, right?
I don't believe we can afford to. But, you know, then the polices or the arguers for the lockdown say that this is not an economic matter, that we cannot fix the economy until we fix the disease. And based on that, I think they will try and prolong this as long as possible. I certainly don't believe that we'll have an open economy before, well, our next summer. And then, of course, the next summer is going to be the fall in the Northern Hemisphere, and that's climatically the time where coronavirus spreads more easily.
Yeah, Canthan, your thoughts on that? Canthan, are you there?
Yeah, I think they are pretty much making... Yeah, I am here. Have you guys got me?
Go ahead, yeah.
Well, I was saying that if you consider the fact that we've been pretty much making it up as we go along right now, there is no incentive on the part of the Ramaphosa government to actually do anything differently because the money has not run out yet. Mm. And until we get to that stage where government themselves have actually completely run out of money, you know, they are really at liberty to have whatever experiments they see fit. And I take Jean-Jacques' point that ultimately this is going to have to be resolved by testing the reasonableness of every injunction in the courts.
Right.
And we have not yet had a case that has been compelling enough, shall we say, to be able to take it to the court and say this is something that absolutely needs now. An exception to it, of course, was, you remember Lindiwe Sisulu, Lindiwe Zulu passing an injunction that kids were not able to move
between their parents.
Where there's co-parenting. And that is one of those cases where she had to back down simply because if that had gone all the way to the Constitutional Court, the unreasonableness of that particular injunction is far greater than the unreasonableness of the lockdown. Right now, in terms of cigarettes, is that likely to be something that the Constitutional Court would think is extreme enough to warrant interference with the emergency, with this state of disaster? I don't think so. Alcohol, I don't think so. Because remember that ultimately our Chief Justice, Mokgweng Mokgweng, is a man of the cloth.
Yes.
And he's very strong on biblical justice, and he's very strong on vices and all of that good stuff. So what is going to be, shall we say, the test case that is going to allow for a steady chipping away of the steady erosion of liberties that are taking place under this government? I don't know at this stage, but I think I'm pretty sure that there are some sharp legal minds who are applying their minds to where is the best place to actually poise a legal challenge, mm-hmm. and to bring it to the government. And let's see where that goes. But I haven't been able to identify that particular piece yet.
Well, Gareth, are we sure that Lindiwe Zulu turned around because she was afraid of losing a case in the Constitutional Court? Or is it simply that she's run out of novel hats and wouldn't have had one to wear for her hearing in that court? We can't be sure, eh?
We just don't know.
Yes, I think that's the theme for this morning. Jean-Jacques, you've added a new catchphrase to our repertoire this morning. Thank you so much. Canthan, thank you as always. And Jean-Jacques Cornish, our two guests to this morning's Burning Platform. Very, very interesting points of view. offered and proffered by both of you. And Jean-Jacques, I hope we'll see you again soon on the Burning Platform. Canton, as always, thank you. We will catch up with you. You wanted to throw something in?
Yeah, I just want to throw something in. You know, given that theoretically we're moving to stage four tomorrow, and of course, Susana Dlamini Zuma has said that there's a once-off exception for traveling between provinces. Mm-hmm. In theory, tomorrow I will be heading back to Gauteng. So it's farewell to views and heading back to Johannesburg on the assumption that I can get the paperwork in place and on the assumption that I don't get shot en route back to Gauteng. I'll keep you guys posted.
All right. Thank you so much and good luck for your travels.
Bon voyage.
Bon voyage. And Jean-Jacques, thank you as always. Merci beaucoup. C'est gentil à vous.
Au revoir, guys. Au revoir.
Cheers. Au revoir. There we go. That is the Burning Platform for this morning, and thank you for joining us. Coming up, Living in Lockdown, a series that we put together on cliffcentral.com, speaking to various South Africans all over the world and in lockdown in various ways, shapes, and forms. You can hear interviews with all of them coming up next. Cliffcentral.com.